We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we're talking with Mitchell Parks about Latin and schoolboy satire in the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, and I am director of campus ministry and adjunct faculty in humanities at Ohio Dominican University.
Today, we're going to be talking with classicist Mitchell Parks about a comical British school story called Molesworth and its influence on Harry Potter. So, Emily, this is something that's a sort of, you know, a schoolboy's satirical view of his own schooling. And I know that although it's this is very British, this work that we're going to be talking about, I wondered if you had read anything like that, if there were books that were like satirical school stories that you read when you were a kid that you liked.
You know, I honestly think, and I hope that listeners will write in to correct me if I'm wrong, but I honestly think that school genre is sort of uniquely British. You know, I mean, I don't think the American experience of school really compares that well to what these stories are coping with. And so, I mean, in our world growing up, school was this like very glamorous place. Because my mom was a teacher, and she was a teacher at the school I would eventually attend for elementary. And she, you know, the whole thing just seemed really glamorous and wonderful in this place that everyone should aspire to, you know. And I know that that's not everyone's experience of American schools.
Yeah, I mean, but, like, you and I are Hermione types. Come on, like, we like school. Like, I was always playing school. Like, I love school.
Yes, playing school. And I was also
the youngest. That is not Molesworth.
No. And I was the youngest of five children. So it was my first crack at peers, having peers instead of being the youngest and being told, you know, bossed around by everybody. So I have to say this, the kind of funnies, you know, I read the funnies in the newspaper. The funnies were always in high demand around our breakfast table. But you know, the funny stuff I read was like Garfield, which is very domestic. It's very domestic, you know, satire or whatever you want to call it. But no, what did you read any?
I asked you this question like having nothing to say for myself on this. So I was like, oh, forgive me, Emily. Yeah. So I think, as I told you before, like if it wasn't fairy tales or if it didn't have people using witchcraft or psychic powers, like I was not interested.
Yes.
When I was a kid. So I had a certain kind of thing that I did enjoy. But I was thinking about my kids have read some things like that. And there was a whole series of these on the shelf in the library that were called, let's see, My Weird School Days, Dan Gutman. You know, Mr. Sunny is Funny.
No.
Mrs. Bolt is Adult. Like, I can't remember. They're all like that. They all have
I miss
that.
These. but I'm also thinking of like Diary of a Wimpy Kid, you know?
Yeah, and, right. But how about Captain Underpants? Like, to me,
Captain
Underpants, I think, is in the Molesworth tradition without being quite so erudite.
Uh-huh.
But it's got all the misspellings. And when I first read Captain Underpants, I was like, what is my kid reading? What is this? But it is very anti-authoritarian, anti-school, you know, that's the villain of the piece, you know? And so it did make me, when I was thinking about it, I thought, oh, maybe Captain Underpants has a little Molesworth influence there. But
yeah,
but hopefully our guest today will help us with this a little bit. We are joined today by Dr. Mitchell Parks, who is Associate Professor of Classics at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. He teaches a variety of classes on the ancient world, ancient democracy, epic poetry, and Greek and Roman myths, and says his research interests lie at the intersection of ancient literature and political theory. He's, quote, interested in how literary works reflect and attempt to overcome the tensions that inevitably arise when humans get together in large groups, end quote. Dr. Parks has several publications and is regularly presented at the Harry Potter Academic Conference, and we are talking today about his presentation last fall titled Marcus Plautus Molesworthus, Latin and the school story tradition at Hogwarts. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell.
Thank you, Katie and Emily. It is an honor to be back here again. I am so flattered and so chuffed to be with you. And yeah, thank you for having me on.
You've definitely reached regular status, so.
That's it is one of the greatest honors of my life, I must say.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Oh.
And I think we have a really funny topic for today because
Yes.
your research is on this connection that we can see some influence flowing back and forth. Well, we can flow, it's flowing in one direction from Molesworth to the Harry Potter series. And especially for non-British audiences, Mitchell, can you tell us what is Molesworth? What is this Molesworth thing?
Okay, so I should confess straight away that I am out of my lane, right? I study the ancient world. I study primary sources from the ancient world mainly. Though, of course, as somebody who's interested in Harry Potter and how that engages with the ancient world, I do like looking at how modern things look back at what was going on in ancient Greek and Roman literature and history. So, in that sense, I guess this is on brand. But yeah, so Molesworth is a parody of the school story, and Emily, in the intro, I think you really hit the nail on the head, which is that this is a British genre. And, it's almost kind of funny, right? We're saying, oh, yeah, that's a British thing on this podcast, which is dedicated to a British school story set of novels, right? But that's not how I, as an American, have generally engaged with the Harry Potter series. And that's an interestingly different cultural frame that you can apply to it, right? And again, I'm totally out of my lane here because I know very little about the school story tradition itself. I rely on other people's scholarship. Emily, you have a piece, for example, on the school story and Harry Potter that I found very helpful. And so there's a long tradition of locating Harry Potter within that school story tradition. What I am asserting or reasserting, I'm not the first person to try to put Molesworth and Harry Potter together, is that a lot of those connections to that tradition seem to be triangulated through this satirical novel called Molesworth, right? And in before I get into exactly what that is, as a classicist, this gets me excited. In working in Latin poetry anyway, some scholars have come up with terms like a window reference or a two-tier allusion to talk about how, okay, well, Harry Potter is engaging with the school tradition, but it's doing it through the window of Molesworth. Or Harry Potter is engaging, as we might talk about later, with the Latin language and with ancient traditions, but again, through something else. You're looking through that window to make that reference. So Molesworth itself is the product of a former British boys' boarding school teacher named Geoffrey Willens, who, after he stopped teaching, wrote a series of kind of satirical essays in the voice of this schoolboy character, Nigel Molesworth. And by the 1950s, he'd been paired up with an illustrator, Ronald Searle, who had also done his own series of boarding school comics. Saint Trinian's was his creation. And so this wonder team of Willens and Searle came out with the in the 1950s, the four Molesworth novels, which now you can usually find together in one set, which star Nigel Molesworth. They are from his perspective. He is a boy who is forced to go to one of these upper class boarding schools in 1950s Britain. They have a lot of schoolboy slang in them, and maybe the signature feature of Molesworth, other than Searle's drawings, which are amazing, the signature feature of Molesworth is that Nigel is an atrocious speller. One of the things you have to get used to is getting into the flow of reading Molesworth as you start attacking it.
And he drops out words and stuff sometimes too. So, yeah.
The
You get into a
punctuation is really
rhythm of it.
spotty.
Yeah.
No,
The
once it
more you
makes sense.
read, yeah, the more you can understand it. And I was, what is the literary term for prose that is written from a point of view character who cannot spell? It's such a funny feature of Molesworth. There's funny on so many levels in what you've shared with us.
And you can see, we'll talk more about other connections soon, I'm sure. But one of the things that immediately sprang to my mind the second I picked up Molesworth the first time was the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and the Quidditch Through the Ages volumes, which are textbooks that have been defaced in
Yes.
there. By the characters from Harry Potter, and so you get their additions and their marginalia, and it's a similar vibe.
Yeah, on that, one of the things that I was thinking about with Molesworth that also started with the Punch humor magazine in Britain was maybe some of our listeners have heard of 1066 and all that, which is a it's a fake British history textbook or English history textbook, and it's pretty hilarious and in the way that it misunderstands, but it cycles through the kinds of stuff that teachers always teach you, right? And you know what the real thing is, but you can see the person like oversimplifying or getting the wording wrong or whatever. And it's a fake textbook in a similar kind of fashion. So.
Mitchell, I'm just curious, how did you come across Molesworth?
When I started teaching a course on Harry Potter, this was in 2015 that I was developing it for the first time. I had come across and kind of trying to gather everything I could about the relationship between Rowling and the classics. I had come across an essay that she wrote for her undergraduate classics journal, Pegasus, at the University of Exeter, reflecting on her time there. And it's from 1998, so it's pretty early in her ascent to fame on the global stage. And it is absolutely charming. It's I'm hardly the first to care about this essay either, for that matter. But I just every time I reread it, I feel like I get something new out of it. And as you all know from conversations that we've had, I'm not the kind of person who thinks that Rowling's word is law on how we interpret the Harry Potter series. But this essay, as a kind of standalone work of scholarship on what it means to read and reread and care about things, I think is just super interesting in its own right. So much of it. And it's very short, and it's freely accessible on the internet, on the University of Exeter's page. It's such an interesting meditation, especially on allusion and reference. Why do we quote things? How do we quote things? How do we make an in-group or a fandom, right? Through making references to fairly arcane stuff. How do you construct that? And she is putting this concept of her own fandom of, say, the Molesworth novels, and this is it comes Molesworth comes up twice in the essay, and that's how I got clued into it and decided I needed to go track that down as well. But she brings in her own fandom of Molesworth, but it's so interesting to compare that to her engagement with the discipline of classics at school in the course of that essay. And so how is an academic discipline like a fandom? How do we have an in language with each other? How do you prove your membership in the group because of what you care about and the kinds of things you say and the way that you say them? And to that end, too, the essay is all about the school experience. What are we made to read in school, and how does that connect with what we read for pleasure? And can you reconcile those two things?
One of the quotes that I think that you referenced had something to do with where she felt like classics was like a gateway to like a hidden realm and runic knowledge, I guess is maybe with a phrase that I'm trying to come up with here, where there's this ancient wisdom or these things that have impact on the world, and she wanted to be one of the people in the know.
Yeah, exactly. So she's narrating the process that led her from being someone who was focused on modern languages, specifically French and German, and she would end up to primarily read, or in American terms, major in, though it's much more than a major, to focus on French. But she did this subsidiary work in Greek and Roman studies, having kick German to the curb. And so the essay is her narrative of dumping German and finding her way into the classics department at the University of Exeter. And so yeah, she says, "Nevertheless, I had somewhere along the line gained the impression that classics meant culture, capital C. As far as I was concerned, behind these doors lay a world of mysterious runic knowledge, and I was keen to be let in." And so there's an intrinsic motivation to going in there, but she doesn't really know why she's doing it or to what end.
But you also suggest that maybe that even impression that that's what classics is might have come through Molesworth.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, if you crack open Molesworth to the most Latin-y chapter of Molesworth, the title is How to Acquire Culture. And keep your brain clean.
And keep the brain clean. Yes, I
Yes.
like that one. It reminds me of the way Harry feels when he realizes there's this magical world. First of all, didn't even know, secondly, that he's invited to be part of it. And thirdly, that he needs training at a special school for wizards. And the kind of fog that he's sort of walking around in is exactly the kind of fog that she's describing, that she's, approaching, not wanting to ask a stupid question. And then some other kid asking this very same question and getting praised by the professor.
Like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, that combination of intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivators that are marking out her school experience are just, it's very much what Harry does, as you say, in entering the magical world. I mean, we get that right away with Harry, who's not much of a reader, right? He doesn't talk about books at all in the early chapters of Harry Potter. We find out just kind of incidentally from the fact that he claims that the messages that he's getting through the mailbox can't be from the library because he doesn't even have a library card, right? We have no positive experiences reported from his early schooling, right? But the second he gets his Hogwarts books in Diagon Alley, he's sitting there up all night, finally actually intrinsically motivated to engage with information, and he names Hedwig after a figure in History of Magic, right? So he's really locked in from that point when he finds the thing that he's been invited into.
Well, where do we see some of the influence from Molesworth into Harry Potter? We have a general, there's a feel, there's a vibe of this experience of going into this school and, maybe classics itself or Latin. So, but what are some of the specific tells that Molesworth is in the background?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And, again, you're absolutely right. The genre, the setting, the tone, it's the school story, but it's not a straight school story in the sense of, looking back to that 19th and early 20th century tradition of the boys' school novel and the girls' school novel, for that matter. The tone is just much more askew in Harry Potter, right? Things are funny. they're not played straight. And I think that that's coming through Molesworth. But Katie, as far as the tells go, these have been pointed out for the last quarter century or so. I'm not the first person to spot them. But right there on the same page spread as that Acquire Culture and Keep the Brain Clean chapter title is our narrator, Nigel Molesworth, being forced to write a Latin play, The Hogwarts, which is, of course, an unusual word, as we all might know, and it just seems to be made up more or less for its nonsense value as the title of this play. But there it is, the name of Harry Potter's school, right there, front and center in Molesworth. And so that's one thing that people have pointed to as a kind of tell, this word that has no other obvious source. Also, there's a very minor character in Molesworth who bears the name Hermione as well. Nigel goes to a boys' school, but he has this kind of reverie imagination section. I mean, many of the essays, these aren't novels in the story, in the sense that they tell a story. They absolutely don't. They're kind of interconnected reflections on the experience of being at a boys' boarding school. And there's one chapter in which he imagines St. Custard's, his school, going co-ed. And he's immediately shown up, particularly at Latin, by all of the girls who have joined St. Custard's. And so there's a figure, Mavis, who absolutely pulls a Hermione Granger in class on him and shows him up. But later on, he also imagines a girl named Hermione, who's a jolly hockey girl, someone who's really into field hockey. So totally different from our Hermione, but you've got the name in there.
Yeah, sounds like Ginny.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good.
Yeah, very good.
So as far as other tells are, the school gives out a Scrimmager Cup for good character. Again, that rare name Scrimmager, which shows up, of course, Rufus Scrimmager, the Minister of Magic, but also first shows up as Brutus Scrimmager in Quidditch Through the Ages, as a sports figure. It's very much on brand for the school story. So there's those weird rare names that
pop
out of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, with Scrimmager, I never thought of the scrimmage part of that, but it's spelled in Molesworth the same way that it's spelled in Harry Potter, more like Scrimjor, right? And so that seems like a really clear, he's obviously misspelling what the cup was in Molesworth, but then that's just lifted straight out for the Minister of Magic.
And then just, you know, one more that I did get to in the talk is the Nigel is constantly talking, and it's right there on the title page of the first novel as well, about various pranks that you can pull as a student. Nigel is not Harry by any stretch of the imagination. Nigel, and I can talk more about this later if you want, Nigel is Dudley. He is not Harry. This is a very different perspective. And I think a lot of things that we associate with Dudley in the novels are maybe coming from the depiction of Nigel Molesworth. But he's always talking about pranks that he could pull. And you know, he uses the mid-century slang wizard to mean really cool. So he talks about pulling all kinds of wizard wheezes on people.
Oh, yeah.
And this is just clearly the source of Fred and George's wizard wheezes, where they have, you know, it's almost like Fred and George have read Molesworth and radically reinterpreted wizard to not be the slang term meaning cool, but just literally magical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And Star Wars fans are also paying attention, prequels fans, especially because that phrase comes in as
a pretty wizard. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's,
yes. In Phantom Menace.
Wizard, the pod racing is very wizard. And it's, and right. It's interesting because although it first appears in Phantom Menace, the prequels had their, you know, their time of shame. And then now they've come back into their own and all the storytelling now moving forward, you have the Mandalorian saying things are wizard. So that's coming up a lot, which is kind of interesting.
That's wonderful. It's so interesting generationally. My students last week, some of them are rewatching the prequels and coming in with these rave reviews of the prequels. And I thought, oh, this is a very interesting conversation that we're having.
They're politically on point right now, especially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, there are even more. There's some of these tells, Katie, as you said, that I didn't even get to in the talk. Right on the very first page, Nigel's introducing himself and St. Custard and St. Custard's and what it's like. Right on the very first page, he uses one of his verbal tics, which is hem hem, which is repeated over and over again through this.
No.
So along with the various other kind of stylistic or language tics that Nigel uses, hem hem is one of them. It's Umbridge uses it as a throat clearing, right? I'm announcing I'm here. Nigel uses it as a kind of tag to say, like, I just made some sort of slightly insinuation-y joke of some kind. It's a way of flagging an insinuation for him.
I feel like this must be intentional in the sense of, like, you were talking about, like, how do you create community for, like, a fan fiction group? Like, it seems like she's intentionally putting in little in-jokes for people who've read Molesworth. Do you think that this is an intent? And, like, why? Why would you do that?
Yeah, and again, we've talked about intent before and how I don't really believe it, but on some level, I think that it's inescapable here, unless we are dealing with truly unconscious memory. And, you know, as a scholar of literature, I tend to avoid the whole question by talking about, what can the reader pick up? What can the reader understand from this so that we don't have to find a lens into Rowling's brain and figure that out? But I think that, if I were writing historical fiction about the writing of the Harry Potter novels, you know, I could imagine an author who was not sure about her own creation, who was trying to figure out how can I make this my own by latching it on to something that I already know and love and that I know that other people know and love. And how can I kind of build those connections with that thing to make this seem less new, which is completely normal for human literature. In the 19th century with the Romantic movement, this idea that everything should just come totally fresh and be new. I think that hasn't really left us for the last two centuries, the idea of originality. Whereas for most of human culture, stuff has been derivative. People have enjoyed existing IP. I'm always telling my students in studying Greek and Roman mythology that this is an entire culture where they just made the collective decision that all fiction was going to take place inside one shared universe. It would be like nowadays if we said, you can write anything you want, it just has to be set in the Star Wars universe.
I'd be okay with that. But
yeah, no, me too.
I was just telling my students, we read a little excerpt of Beowulf in my early Britain class, and I was like, this is like Marvel Universe stuff for the people who lived. Like, they're just telling stories, and they're all in the same realm, and that's why you get these little side bits about these other people. And they're kind of maybe historically connected, but maybe not. Maybe you just make up some nice tales there. But yeah, that it's kind of like, I think the Marvel stories like have just multiplied so much, but I mean the Star Wars stories multiplied
Well,
a lot too. So
and
school
that's
stories were like that too. School stories were drawing on that familiarity, not only the familiarity, I think, of people's experience in schools, but also the familiarity of these various stories. And they were drawing on that to gain readership. And so I do think that your theory is right. And my very limited experience of novel writing, it is an instinct to hide little gems in there that really are only important to you, you know? And then if somebody else gets it, well, then you've made a new best friend, right? But if it's like a little rabbit trail, like you hope somebody's going to notice this, but it doesn't matter if they don't, right? Because you love it.
Illusion is such a delicate art, right? And I think one thing that makes the Harry Potter novels so successful is that when they are ripping something else off, it often feels more at home in Harry Potter than it does in the source material. You know,
So true.
it's been naturalized and brought in such a way that it forms this cohesive whole. And that's what's so satisfying about all of these literary connections, you know, the kinds of things that Beatrice Groves tracks in Literary Illusion and Harry Potter, right? That these have just they have a home made for them there in the series, and it all clicks together and makes sense.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in like you've got this whole school story tradition, and I mean I Molesworth is funny, but why would you do so many references to this satirical and shady, you know, kind of shady way of presenting the school tradition? How does that satirical aspect of Molesworth lead us to maybe satirical understandings of Harry Potter and what Harry Potter is saying about school?
Right. Well, you know, I think that part of it is at least coming at it, I'll try to swap back to the reader's perspective instead of the author's perspective here. As a reader, I think it gives Harry Potter the series an out in terms of a lot of the stuff that happens at Hogwarts is ridiculous, right? There's this big layer of fantasy. It's unbelievable. Argus Filch is one of these kind of stereotypical characters
Oh,
of kind
yeah.
of the monsters that these school stories can produce,
He's the corporal
right?
punishment guy, right?
Exactly, right, from the boarding school tradition. And so it gives Harry Potter an out in terms of, okay, we can include all of these elements, but it can be a little wink, wink, ridiculous. And even more so because Harry Potter is literal fantasy, right? It's almost like the satire just kind of transmutes into this is now complete imagination. We're off in a fantasy space. And so it can be something a little bit different. I think too, especially as we're looking at early Harry Potter, the early chapters of Harry Potter are so interwoven with Roald Dahl as well. And as you were talking in the intro about school stories, you know, my only experience with that as a kid was loving Roald Dahl so much and checking out his books, not just his fiction, but also his autobiographies from the school library over and over and over again. And just, you know, we're at my house right now, we are reading Matilda aloud. So it's been really nice to re-experience that. But the idea of all these incompetent and malevolent grown-ups that Harry is surrounded with are so much drawn from Roald Dahl, and the idea too of smeltings, right? Dudley's school smeltings, where you all get a stick to whack each other with, and that's an important part of gaining character. That
That's kind of like
that's
the wands, though,
well,
right?
right. So the more things change, the more things stay the same. Harry and his friends are given tools that kill people. They're on immediately on entry into the wizarding world, and they do smack each other with them, right? They duel and all kinds of horrible things with them. And so, yeah, smeltings is not actually all that different. I mean, the smeltings colors are practically the Gryffindor colors, for that matter, once Dudley gets his uniform. So, you know, in a sense, Dudley is sent off to Nigel's Satan Custards, which is this more violent, rough and tumble, down to earth but satirical space. Whereas Hogwarts is fantasy and more earnest. It shares a lot of those traits, but it's elevated in that way.
Yeah, and it has a plot, and its plot is earnest, you know, in that sense. But some of the features of the setting are more humorous.
Mitchell, my face is already starting to hurt from laughing so much throughout our conversation, and rightly so because of the subject matter. And I just it kind of strikes me that there is such humor in this book that's fundamentally about, you know, mortality, human mortality. So, What do we make of this? What role does Molesworthian humor play in these stories? And is there any shade of that in Molesworth at all? Or is it all just fun and games in Molesworth?
Yeah, Molesworth, I would say Molesworth is mostly fun and games. Unlike your traditional children's literature, you know, there are references to Proust in it. So, you know, there's a kind of literary okay. kind of intentional pretentiousness. Right. That, you know, Nigel is such a curious character because he's both extremely well educated and can't write to save his life. You know, he's clearly a child being written by an adult, and that is an intent. Okay, again, going back to intent, it reads like an intentional part of it. The part of the humor is that Nigel, you know, that Nigel is not actually a child. But to get back to your question, I think the line between satire and fantasy, to go back to that, is very thin. And in a way, they're both, you know, involved in wish fulfillment. We have, you know, things that we want in this world, and we can kind of bring them to life. And that's, we get that in Nigel's wizard wheezes, these pranks that he imagines. And they go beyond pranks. At one point, you know, he does something that's very much like Fred and George's patented daydream charm, where he says that he can provide you with a daydream that lasts all through your class, which I think is another one of those references, right? So there's that fantasy about, you know, what can you as a powerless student manage to accomplish? But death is a pretty hard line there in terms of wish fulfillment. And I would say that Harry Potter is fundamentally more serious than Molesworth. And it's one of the strengths of the series that it can ingest something like Molesworth that is so different from it thematically and still deploy it to an interesting effect. I've never been a huge fan of the idea that any particular text is a key to unlocking the meaning of Harry Potter, right? Yes. Because it is so omnivorous. And, you know, we can fortunately say, okay, well, there's Molesworth stuff going on here, but there's other stuff too, that there's something fundamentally serious going on about the nature of love and death that isn't in this one particular source text.
Totally. We've talked before about how when you're dealing with such a serious topic, having humor, it not only helps to like alleviate some of the heaviness or the seriousness, but it also highlights the seriousness in a really important way. And it strikes me that there's something that the Molesworthian bit is sort of highlights, like, oh, but then there's this serious stuff that's happening here.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think that this is one of those instances where a source text kind of gravitates itself. I see this happening with a lot of ancient literature, too. A source text kind of gravitates itself into particular characters in the series. And so the Molesworthian heart of Harry Potter is in Fred and George.
Right.
And it's in Peeves. Peeves is also kind of as this spirit of unruly adolescence the kind of you can't get rid of it. And it's a wonderful metaphor within a literary work for it to talk about its predecessor as a kind of ghost you can't get rid of, right? Or a poltergeist in this case, to be more literal.
I love that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Molesworth is causing chaos at Hogwarts, kind of in the background there through them.
So one of the things, you know, you were talking about like the thematic differences, but especially more recently, people, including me, have pointed out kind of imperialist, I don't know, overtones, undertones, an imperialist mindset that comes through the Harry Potter books. And you had described in your presentation Molesworth as being a critic of, but also an aspirant to imperialism. And so I was interested in what you saw as the connections there between the imperialistic qualities of Molesworth and maybe Harry Potter Wizarding World.
Yeah, and I'll admit, you know, I'm out of my lane here too. I'm not a specialist in 20th century British politics. I've watched The Crown, right? But that's
that's plenty. That's plenty.
Yeah. So but this
well,
is
I don't
Molesworth
know.
Is coming in the 50s at this time of huge transitions for the UK, right? In terms of their relationship to their colonies and then their former colonies, and so Nigel expresses a lot of cynicism about the British Empire, and he's coming at a time where you know the school. story had been in the 19th century tradition, this kind of rah-rah, you know, Britain will rule everything, everywhere the light touches is yours, Simba, that kind of
that I mean, it was one of the engines driving it, really.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Training the next generation of leaders.
Mm-hmm. And but then you get a, you know, more cynicism about that kind of very much, you know, and they're using in the 19th and early 20th century antiquity to drive a lot of that, this kind of patriotic self-sacrifice for the good of the country. And you have poetry coming out of World War One, you know, poets like Wilfred Owen, who are rewriting that, you know, the kinds of things that they learned in this school system turn out to be fairly hollow values when you're faced with gas and barbed wire and all of these, you know, the horrors of the 20th century battlefield, right?
But I would say, too, just to speak to your earlier point, like the British think they're doing something similar to what the Romans were doing in terms of creating a vast space of civilization in which peace and commerce can flourish, you know? And so they think that they're bringing civilization to far reaches of the globe in a way that I think is straight out of classical, you know, ideas about Rome and the Roman Empire.
Absolutely. And that gets us into, you know, why are they learning so much Latin in these novels as well? Mm-hmm. But to wrap up the previous question, it's, you know, Nigel's cynical about that, and he's inheriting a lot of the cynicism from the World Wars and also this kind of entering post-imperial period. But there's so much nostalgia in there, too. And he's in a remarkably traditionalist conservative space, the boys' boarding school. Which is, you know, he's coming in kind of at the end of that, not that that tradition doesn't still exist today, but I, you know, he's self-aware that he's at the end of its heyday. And there's something that he's looking forward to, like, could we do that again? Right. And I think, you know, Katie, you're absolutely right in pointing out that Harry Potter, in coming after the Cold War and, you know, is at a similar kind of period of transition, right, for what is Britain up to, what could they be up to, what does the world stage look like at this moment of transition. And of course Harry's not James Bond. You know, I think of Newt Scamander is much more James Bond, kind of traveling to other countries and solving their problems whether they want him to or not, right? So, you know, in a sense he's kind of, but though he's doing it extra legally, is that better?
Right, and more without, awkwardly also.
Yeah. Oh, well, charmingly. Absolutely charmingly. But he's doing it without government backing, which I guess makes him less of a James Bond in that particular sense. You know, Harry at least is not going and interfering in foreign governments.
I mean, the stuff in book
four. Does the mission to the giants count?
And yeah, there's some kind of, right. And, but one of the things that I think is kind of imperialistic is that Britain is just still felt as the center of everything, right? And you have this rising villain in Voldemort, and then the whole international community, which is really just Europe, is supposed to also kind of come in and participate in this. And it's a sort of, it's almost reflexive imperialism, is I think maybe what I've called it in other settings.
I do agree with you that there are those imperialist themes in Harry Potter, but it's less... Yeah, Dumbledore doesn't seem to be trying to, you know, take over other countries or harken back to an era where they were doing that.
Yeah, I don't think Dumbledore is so into that particularly, but I did do a paper for Chestnut Hill that was called Quidditch and Cultural Imperialism that was about the export of this sport Quidditch globally. That was very imperialistic. It's like cricket and through the British Empire, you know, and other kinds.
Oh, absolutely.
Rugby as well. So I think that there are these little, you know, glimpses of that. And I think you're right to use the word nostalgia. And I think that you're right to identify that, you know, kind of 90s, mid-90s, that there was in Britain, maybe this kind of a nostalgia for an imagined earlier time of being the center of a great empire somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those things that gets me on this is the place of Latin in that empire building.
Yeah.
There's so much focus in Molesworth on the use of Latin. And this was a big portion of my talk was linking that to the omnipresence of Latin in Harry Potter in the form of the spells.
Yeah, well, let's get to the Latin part, Mitchell.
This is part of Nigel's schooling. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, let's go ahead. Yeah. Let's talk about Latin. And because I think that you see... You're sort of seeing the Latin in Molesworth and the use of Latin and some of the other kinds of kind of classical references in Harry Potter as creating, an important little network there that we could examine more deeply. So tell us about, all of the Latin and how you see that connecting Molesworth and Harry Potter and ultimately what it all means.
So, in the school story tradition and in real life, right, with British imperialism, this Latin education is going hand in hand with taking one's place in the middle class and or in the officer class, right? You study Latin at school as a kind of handshake to prove that you have passed the test that every other gentleman has passed, and therefore you can join the club. And the reason that Latin is the focus is that Latin was the language of the Romans, who were the empire builders that the British were trying to emulate, right? And we can see this if I can flash briefly over to one of the Galbraith novels, Running Grave, the Seventh Strike novel, which is the one with the cult. At the cult compound, this is a new age cult that's seeming to draw on all kinds of especially East Asian influences in how it's made up. It seems it's intentionally designing itself as exotic seeming, very very othering in this way. But at the core of it, at one point, Robin, who's undercover at the cult, walks past an inscription on a, I think it's on a paving stone there, which is Stet Fortuna Domus. It's a little bit of Latin, and it's the motto of Harrow, which is the boarding school that the cult founder attended. And of course, it's from Virgil. It's from Virgil's Georgics. It's saying to us that at the core of this cult, which is notionally so kind of new and weird and looking elsewhere, actually the firm basis is this British imperialism rooted in the study of Latin in a very traditionalist way, and the cult is just another mechanism for the elite to re-entrench themselves. That this is a new way for the powerful to stay powerful. And that is, at the core of it, it's this very, very traditionalist, boys' club.
Yeah, and what I liked about like the example that you gave there is that it's a little performative piece of Latin, right? It's supposed to say, this is who I am, right? It puts you in a club, it puts you in a group. So if you're paying attention, you're gonna see, but a lot of people just go right past them.
Yeah, well, and we get that in the Harry Potter novels as well. Where the Gryffindor tower passwords especially have a tendency to be Latin, and unlike the spells, which are kind of mangled Latin, comical Latin of various kinds, the Gryffindor tower passwords tend to be actual Latin instead. And so it's the password for getting into the literal upper echelons of the school, is to be able to speak Latin at the portrait of the fat lady.
When I was again reading the portions of Molesworth that you shared with us, I was thinking about the kind of bumbling nature of Molesworth himself and the kind of criticisms of the Latin used for the spells, that it's kind of bungled Latin, right? And so I was thinking about that as yet another connection,
It's
again
Latin
in
as
this.
written by Nigel. So he's exposing, and Nigel Molesworth is exposing this kind of narrow focus. They do so much Latin at the school, and it occupies so much of his attention. At one point, he's engaged in a sort of dream about meeting Martians, and he says that's not going to happen though, because, quote, "You cannot have everything, particularly at school, where you get practically nothing except Latin and the cane." Right, which so just this kind of intellectual punishment combined with corporal punishment, right? There's all kinds of good reasons to learn Latin, but Nigel, and in the chapter that I sent you, Nigel alludes to some of them. There's an innate interest in history, but the teacher cannot articulate that. He completely fails when being interrogated, why one should actually study the ancient world, whereas Nigel brings up pretty good reasons, historical interest in what happened in the past, that kind of thing.
Like a
And
Professor
instead,
Binns, right? I mean,
right.
I thought that was pretty clear reference there.
Yeah, and so you use the word performative, and that's exactly it. It gets us to the Hogwarts school motto, Draco dormiens numquam titillandus. Why does Hogwarts have a Latin motto? Well, because it's in the school tradition, and so it should. And I'm not the first person to point this out, but never tickle a sleeping dragon can easily be read as a metaphor for don't question the system, right? This is let sleeping dogs lie. Just keep your head down and do what the system asks of you, which is very much in line with the kind of character formation of taking Latin that I think is being envisioned in the school story, and that certainly comes out in the first Harry Potter novel in Hermione, right, where you know, she expresses this very much kind of death before dishonor kind of thing when she says we could get killed or worse, expelled, right? That this is that kind of schoolboy value which they're inheriting from their study of ancient Sparta. Shout out to my History of Ancient Greece students who are going to get, after we're done with this conversation, they're going to get Sparta today. Nice. So we're working on that.
And yet, have we brought this up that Latin is never itself taught at Hogwarts?
Right. Yeah. And so that is the crux here for why I got interested in this. It's one thing to point out all these allusions, and it's fun, and Molesworth is extremely funny. You know, a listener should go check it out. It's an acquired taste. You do have to get into it, as we were saying earlier, but it is very funny. But yeah, the key here in terms of, you know, why bother other than pointing out yet another thing that Harry Potter seems to be ingesting and recycling in some way, is that it answers the question that I've been interested in a while, you know, what's going on with the Latin in the Harry Potter novels? In particular, the fact that the students are taught to do spells, they're taught to memorize spells, they're taught to recreate particular effects with the magic, but they're not generally taught theory or the ability to dream beyond the thing that they're taught. And in the Molesworth novels, Nigel's experience of Latin is incredibly machine-like. You know, they are supposed to be turning English sentences into Latin and Latin sentences into English in this kind of one-to-one fashion. They're not being told why they should bother learning this. It's all very rote-based, very, very machine-like. And so there's a... you know, that tie to, you know, why do the students struggle to fight Voldemort and his ilk, where they're not allowed to get creative? They don't study literature. They don't study things that could produce things. And we get that in History of Magic in Hogwarts as well, right? I think Professor Binns is the ultimate symbol of this, where in Chamber of Secrets, Hermione is arguing that, you know, the myth of the Chamber of Secrets is real. It has actual effects and you can learn about it and take that knowledge to do something else with it. Whereas Professor Binns is very much a kind of dead end kind of person, as we learn in that rolling essay that she wrote for her alma mater. Professor Binns is based on one of her classics professors as well, and so that's you know, one aspect of her experience with the ancient world was that, you know, here's a series of dry facts which are not connected to something that I'm going to do with them in some way, and so this points out a gap in the education system.
And another use of a ghost to serve as sort of a metaphor for what's maybe still haunting the education system.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
Or that it's dead, right? There's nothing that can be done further with it. So you're reminding me that Beth Sutton Ramsbeck had, and it was like a chapter in a book about
creativity.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that there aren't very many people who do creative magic. You're just supposed to learn what's already there.
Right.
Because I was thinking at first, I was thinking, you know, if they were taught Latin, they could anticipate what the spell was going to do.
Yeah. If Harry knew Latin before casting Sectum Sempra,
right,
he would have been much better advised about it. You know, Snape is pictured as creative, but he's also uncontrolled in that creativity. Well,
right. And Luna's mother dies for her magical
That's
creativity.
That's right. And Beth points out also Voldemort is creative. It's creative with magic, but also the Weasley twins, and they're on the good side, but they're also trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
And Mr. Weasley as well is creative with magic. But again, he it's consequential for him in a negative way.
Right. And so, yeah, they're not really taught how to do that. And if they were taught the language itself, they would have the tools for it. But there's this massive disconnect. I mean, it's almost like the system that they're in doesn't want to be changed.
Yeah.
Which, again, that's where the traditionalism of the school story reasserts itself.
Mm-hmm. And and it starts with like a little comic, you know,
yeah.
It seems like, you know, so it's just goes to show the depth of what you can find when you investigate these things.
So I can't help but also think about this conversation about creativity and, using words when you don't really know what they mean and all of that, and what this
Right.
has to say about our present moment with generative AI and artificial intelligence, and how, people are using things and they don't necessarily know what where they came from or what it actually means or does. So
Right,
what do you think about that connection?
the bane of every college professor's existence right now, of course.
Yeah.
And so, again, students who are trapped in this kind of traditional educational system, like Nigel, at one point, one of his wizard wheezes is to come up with what he calls an electronic brain specifically for cheating, an electronic brain that will produce answers for you. So
Wow.
he predicts generative AI and its use in the classroom really quite effectively. From his perspective in the 1950s. And so, from Nigel's perspective, it seems like a reasonable response, right? But if students are coming out of this educational system with this idea that there's only one right answer to everything, you need to memorize exactly the thing because you're being taught to the test, right? Then this notion that, oh, I can just get something else to think for me, seems totally fine. But because the Hogwarts students, because Nigel isn't being given the tools to think creatively for himself, he doesn't realize its value and realize its potential, and doesn't know that it's something actually that he should resist, this idea that he should not be doing his own thinking. But I
Right.
again, I'm not an expert in this, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about generative AI as well, and how we can
Yeah, Katie.
protect
Yeah, we don't
that
have time for all of that. But yeah, but I
man.
feel very, very strongly that it is, it's like I'm going to use Star Trek reference now, but it's like the Borg come along and they say resistance is, and we're like, we'll take it. We'll just make ourselves machines. We don't want to be human anymore. We're just going to make ourselves machines and we'll be part of a hive mind. And, and we're happy to do that. We're just racing to our chains, is what I say. And I'm not being hyperbolic. I really think this is a kind of way
Thanks,
to
Jill.
enslave masses of humanity. So I really think it's very important, this notion that you've said that the school tradition is just perform it, right? And it's you talked about that with the Latin, where you're given the Latin sentence, you make it into an English system, there's a sentence, there's a right answer. And I have students who, like, I think they really think I want a perfect essay about Alfred the Great, right?
Well, and
And
a generic essay, right? The thing that everybody would
right.
say about it. And that's, you're
Yeah.
not trying to teach them that. You're trying to teach them how
No.
to read and think for themselves and to say something weird, right? That
Yeah.
your probabilistic generative AI is not going to spit out.
No, I love the weird. I'm here for the weird, right? And I tell
I am
students, like, I'm
too.
trying to listen to you. I want to hear you in it. And I
Yeah.
don't need a perfect, like, if I wanted a perfect essay, I would write it myself. This is what I say.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
But like, I
I'm
want.
using that in class. I'm using that.
But I want to hear what they think about it and to give them the tools to be thoughtful people. And when you are, when you're just going straight to there's a right answer and I just have to produce it, that's when these ideas of assistance and helps can do that. And I think about, like there are cheating devices at Hogwarts as well, right? That they ban the quill or whatever that will write the correct answers for you and so on. And but you have to investigate the nature of the school system. I do think higher ed is, well, I will say higher ed has raced to AI very quickly, which I thought was a huge mistake. But that is because of this focus on workplace ready that suggests that we're all just supposed to be drones in the system and, do your work and collect your salary and don't think too hard. Don't tickle sleeping dragon, right?
Well, it's also a function too of what class controls higher ed. Who are the people on boards of trustees,
Yeah.
who are the administrators of institutions instead of the people in the classroom, and where does that tension put us in terms of different priorities?
Yeah, and I think it also though speaks to the regulation of the K through 12 system. And like you said, teaching to the test before, and that, I think that of course we want to know that students are learning, but the way that we control every aspect of what teachers are allowed to do in their classrooms, and we don't give teachers the respect to actually teach the students they have. I call it the industrial model of schooling. I didn't invent that, right? But the idea is you take all the little children in, you put them through the machine, and then you're going to churn out identical good workers, right? And I just, you can tell that this bothers me. This is,
Right. Well,
you know, because kids are
again,
so
thinking,
different.
I'm thinking of the news, even at the college level in the last couple of weeks, where in Texas, they cut Plato readings from a syllabus, of course,
Right.
where, right,
Plato, that
Plato,
radical.
geez, yes.
He's too
Wow.
woke. Yeah, but that
Wow.
shows you, right? That shows you that this stuff still has potential impact, right? They're worried that people are going to read Plato and get ideas.
Right.
They're going to leave the cave.
Yep. Indeed.
Okay, so I'm looking at our time and I think we're about out of time, but I wanted to make sure, Mitchell, was there anything else that you want to talk about? We didn't get to all of our questions, but
Oh,
we
I
had
mean,
such a good conversation.
yeah, if people who pick up Molesworth, I look forward to your detective hunt in terms of what you can find. There's so many things that we didn't even have time to talk about. Nigel takes a train trip up to Scotland on the Flying Scotsman train at one point, and the has an experience with the dining car where he eats wizard toasts and cakes and things. And once again, that's another literalization thing going on. If you check out the talk I gave at Chestnut Hill, as well, which is available on YouTube. I'm so grateful for the conference organizers for putting all those talks up there because it enables me to catch ones that I couldn't catch at the conference
Right, me
itself,
too.
and to get to watch those. So in the talk, I did a bit of kind of corny showmanship where I ended the talk on a kind of and here's another surprising thing that pops out at you about Phineas Nigellus Black. And so anybody who's interested in that could go check out the video version of that. There's a lot of breadcrumbs in here that people can continue to find.
So what's next for you, Mitchell? Are you I'm sure that you don't seem to run out of the various, references that you can follow through the classics in these books. So what are you thinking about next?
Well, I have the advantage in that I've been thinking and teaching about Harry Potter for a long time, but I'm a relatively recent comer to the Harry Potter Academic Conference. And so I've got all the material kind of built up from there,
Awesome.
that I can keep bringing out. I'm still working on my book manuscript on classics and Harry Potter. I'm within a stone's throw of finishing the darn thing. And
Fantastic.
so, yeah, we'll see what happens with that after I've kind of finished this first big draft of it. But then I'm interested in things that have a history of being studied within my own discipline, but maybe not so much within Harry Potter studies, like lists and catalogs. In looking over the novels, I've been kind of looking at instances where you just get these big long lists of things. And in classics, we understand lists as a function of genre, and we can analyze them for their rhetorical effect and for their thematic connections. And so right now I've got kind of lists on the brain.
I didn't know that. I'm about to, just in a few minutes, I'm going to teach a little bit about the Declaration of Independence. And I was like, it's
Cool.
just a list.
Yes.
It's a list of complaints. So, yeah. Okay. But I hadn't thought about it as having a genre.
The epic catalog is a thing from the Iliad onward, where you get a big, long, detail-rich list, and then you try to figure out what does this mean for the text as a whole. So that's kind of on my brain now, but I would say, anybody interested in the ancient world and Harry Potter, I would always say go back to the epigraphs at the start of Deathly Hallows. I crack those open on a regular basis to try to think about, what are the new connections that could be drawn here. But those are just so productive. So in a general way, my mind's on lists, my mind's on those epigraphs like it always is.
Now we
And
know your
yeah.
secrets.
Yes.
Watch out.
Giving them away for free here. Yeah.
Well,
That's
thank you
great.
so much, Mitchell Parks, for being on the show
Well,
today.
thank you once again for having me. It is always a pleasure.
Today, we are simply closing with a little bit of Latin. And I've contemplated using the Hogwarts school motto, which Dr. Parks mentioned before, and I will not pronounce as well. Draco dormiens nunquam titillandus, never tickle a sleeping dragon. But in place of that stodgy bit of Latin, I'm going to use a little faux Latin spell language for our final quote today. Expelliarmus. Until next time, class dismissed.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook and Instagram. Potterversity is produced by Laurie Beckoff and edited by Lan Deer. Our announcer is Sarah Brown. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Ellsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Prinzi, Ashley Shepard, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsburn.